Okay, good evening everyone here and at home on your computer. Tonight we're going to discuss Ace of Sona Lyakhov. So for the last 5 weeks we've done classical anti-Semitism of the pagan era, the pre-Christian era, and soon we're going to turn to the common era and Christian anti-Judaism. But tonight is a good night, being the 83rd anniversary of Kristallnacht, to focus on Jewish interpretations, classical rabbinic interpretations of anti-Semitism. What did our sages think about it? And did they agree in their interpretation? We'll see that they did not. There are very, very different approaches among our own clergy about how the problem of anti-Semitism ought to be understood. Now, just to spend a few moments on Kristallnacht, in past lectures and past years, I've mentioned, made the point that I'm not so pleased with Holocaust Remembrance Day or the various days that exist on the calendar. There are drawbacks to each and every one of them. The Yom HaShoah, which was established by the Knesset in 1951, is to correspond to the Warsaw Ghetto Uprising, except that was Pesach time in the month of Nisan, and so 27th of Nisan is not really an ideal date. It's an arbitrary date picked by political leaders, not by the religious hierarchy. The 27th of January, which is International Holocaust Remembrance Day, corresponds to the liberation of Auschwitz in 1945, and that sometimes gets hijacked by international actors that are hostile to Judaism. And Tisha B'Av, which is used by some in the traditional world for Holocaust remembrance purposes, the drawback is it takes away from the conventional purpose of Tisha B'Av to recall the lost temples of ancient days. So, in my view, Kristallnacht really is the true Yom HaShoah, November 9-10, when the persecution of Jewry goes from being what is comparatively a low-level issue to being a matter of life and death for lots and lots of people. 91 people die, 30,000 are sent to concentration camps, thousands of Jewish shops are destroyed, 277 synagogues are destroyed. So this was the major turning point. Other, yes, in one night it all happened. It's very, very fast, yeah. And I mean, in past seasons, we've discussed the personality of Herschel Greenspan, who shot Ernst von Rath, who was a diplomat in Paris, which led to, eventually von Rath's death. And then that was the proximate cause for the pogrom. But really, it was a bluff because a pogrom was going to happen anyway. This was just the Nazi Party looking for something to pin it on. And here, Herschel becomes the fall guy. So we recall. It's been 83 years, but this was a major event in the history of the Jewish people and ought to be the day in which the Shoah is recalled. So let's now turn to our topic for tonight of Esav son of Yaakov, Esau hates Jacob. Pasha's told us was this past Shabbos, so it's a good time to speak about that anyway. So the Gemara tells us in Pesachim, Gedola sin'a tamid, greater is the hatred that the intellectual underclass, the Amaratzim, hate the scholars, Yisrael, greater than the enmity or the hatred that the Gentiles have for the Jews. So this was a line in the Talmud basically acknowledging that intramural hatred among Jews is a bad thing. And in fact, it's an even bigger problem, or rather more intense than what the Goyim hate the Jews. Is that really true?
Sure.
Sometimes it could be true. You have sometimes internal Jewish fights can be very intense. But for our purposes tonight, I'm not so interested in that. What I'm more concerned with is the idea that Umot HaOlam, the nations of the world, hate the Jews. Sonin et Israel. We don't find this all that many times in rabbinic literature, the idea that collectively the nations of the world hate Israel. We'll find that we have bad relations with specific national groups with whom we've had ongoing controversy for centuries. But the idea that it's everybody against us, Umot HaOlam in their totality versus Yisrael, you don't see that too often in the Talmud. That's why I point this line out. Okay. So if there's one line in the Gemara that speaks about the origins of hatred in the world between Jews and heathens, what line is it? And in reference to what place on earth is it? Nope, no, not Eretz Yisrael.
Can we come off mute now?
They're on mute, but I'm not going to unmute them because otherwise we'll have a balagan.
I'm talking about us.
Oh, you can go off mute, yeah. What's the answer? Har? No? Har Sinai. My Har Sinai. What is the meaning of Har Sinai? Har Shirada Sinai Lumot HaOlam Alav. Then the mountain on which hatred came down into the world. Sinai, Sina. Oh, yeah. Now, it's not the same word, though, because Sinai is with a Samach and Sinai is with a Sin. Okay, but in homiletics, you can play around with the letters. As long as it sounds good, it is good. Or it is terrible in this instance. The hatred comes into the world. The truth of the matter is, the original meaning of this Gemara was not that this is the origin of the Gentiles hating the Jews. The original meaning of the Gemara was, this is the origin of God being displeased with the Gentiles because here the Jews are keeping the Torah and the Gentiles are not. So Sinai is coming down from Shamayim onto the earth because of the disparity between a Sinai covenanted group like Israel and everybody else who's, you know, deficient spiritually. But as the generations went on, the assumption of the interpreters was that the meaning of Sinai coming down into the world is that the heathens become angry with the Jews because the Jews are different religiously, and that difference morphs into a visceral hatred.
That's so, no difference than the pagan times.
So the question is, were the rabbis aware of differences between tolerant paganism that could accept the idea that you have different laws than I do, and intolerant monotheistic faiths, or whatever an intolerant form exists later? Right, so the rabbis did not do a very good job of distinguishing between the two. So let's look at Rosh HaSaran. The Ran, who's writing in the 13th century, says the following. All those problems that exist between us and the pagans, or between us and the heathens, is because we have different religions. Right, we have an emunah, a faith that is not their faith. Like it says in Tractate Shabbos, why is it called Sinai? Because Sinai comes into the world, hatred comes into the world. All the suffering and the sicknesses that come from the Gentiles onto me, onto our people, are because of I love God, the Jewish, the God of Israel. That God in his infinite wisdom causes us to behave differently than them. When it's chaten b'hem, we don't intermarry. We don't eat their food. We don't eat treif. And when you can't intermarry and when you can't share a table fellowship with them, the end result is they hate your guts. So the Ran is acknowledging religion is what causes this, as opposed to race differences, physiological differences. He's not saying that they think that we're the devil incarnate because we're physically different. We just live different types of lives, believe different types of things, and that's why they're not going to be nice to us.
So does he believe that's the only reason and economics never entered into their minds?
So the question of whether economic anti-Semitism was something that the rabbis appreciated, I think we can find in the writing of the Rishonim plenty of evidence that they understood there was economic anti-Semitism. The notion of plunder, of mamonam shel Yisrael, they want the money of Israel, we do find that. We do find it. We also find, for example, the idea that a person borrows money from a Jew at interest, because that's allowed. We could lend money with interest to a Gentile. But what does he do? He converts to Judaism, so he doesn't have to pay it back, because a Jew can't pay back interest. So they're aware of shenanigans related to the money between Jews and Gentiles, and that it could cause ill feelings. But what the rabbis had trouble with was this idea that we are good to everyone, we love everyone, we pray for everyone, we offer korbanot for everyone, and there is no hakarat hatov, appreciation by the other side for the good that we do on their behalf. So the Tehillim we find, Tachat Ahavati Yistanuni Vani Tefillah, that in place of the love which we are extending outward to the non-Jewish world, Yistanuni, there is enmity. Umishalmei Ra'at Tachat Tova, that they are paying a kindness with an improper deed. The Gemara in Sukkah, of course it's Sukkah, says, well, we offer sacrifices, the 70 bulls, the Shivim Parim of Sukkot, on behalf of the Shivim Utaolam, the 70 nations of the world. And only one little korban on Shmini Atzeres is for Am Yisrael. So we do all this stuff on our holiday, in our sanctuary, in our temple, for the well-being of the Gentile world. And their reaction is to put a knife in our back. So the rabbis really believe this stuff. They thought that the Jewish people are doing so much for humanity. Not so much in the sense of like winning Nobel Prize and Jonas Salk and a vaccine for polio, but in the spiritual realm of we daven for you, we make korbanos for you, and what are you doing? You're being mean to us.
Of course, we say Shalom Asani Goy every day.
We can get to that actually in the origins of Shalom Asani Goy. I think I spoke about it once before, but I'll address it tonight also. Okay, so let's now turn to Esav, because as I said, tonight's topic is Esav Sona LeYaakov. Esau hates Jacob. The classic verse that is used to expound this lesson is not in this week's Torah reading, but in next week's Torah reading, Vayishlach, Vayarot Esav Likrato, Vayichabekehu, Vayipol Savaro, Vayishakehu Vayivku. That after many years apart, Esav and Yaakov, the brothers, have a reunion, and Yaakov feared what would happen at this reunion. He puts his camp he divides his family into two camps in case that they attack one, the other one will be a refugee, a survivor. He really thinks the worst could happen. But when push comes to shove, they come together. It's not a gunfight, it's a hug and a kiss, and they cry. Okay, so the Midrashim are in the business of besmirching Esav. They say he tried to bite him in the neck and his teeth broke. Okay, also the little Midrash says there's a nice picture of that. But what does the Sifri say? Forget the little Midrash, let's go to the big Midrash, the Sifri. Vayishakehu, nakur alav, there are dots on the word Vayishakehu, shalon ashako b'cholibo, that he did not do this wholeheartedly. Rather, this was something of a scam. He's luring him in, and then he'll go for the kill. But Rabbi Shimon bar Yochai Omer, Halo biyadua she Esav son el Yaakov. It is known that Esav hates Yaakov. Yadua, it is a known thing. No chiddush here. No, it's a known thing. Esau hates Jacob. But in this instance, that's not how it played itself out. Ela nehapchura chamav votasha unishakol b'chol libo. In the moment, the feelings overwhelmed him, positive feelings, and he kissed him with a full heart. So here the Tanakhama, the first opinion says it was a scam. It was not with a full heart. And then Shimon bar Yochai says, well, regularly speaking, we would say, yeah, he's a bad apple and he hates us. But in this particular instance, it was sincere. It was sincere. Well, there's one key word in that Sifri that does not appear in some of the later writings, but rather is bastardized in the later writings. If you know your Rashi, it doesn't say halo biyadua. What does it say? Halacha biyadua. Now, halo biyadua is like sort of incredulously, yeah, we know in general that Esav hates Yaakov, but halacha means what? It's a rule. It's like an axiom of history that this is the way it has to be. It must be. It always is. So what's the correct recension of the text? Is it really halo or is it halacha? So the academic scholars will tell you that the original reading was halo. But what happens when you want to be terse in your writing in a manuscript? You'll often put an apostrophe after a few letters of a word and not complete the full word, like shenamar is like shin and nun and an apostrophe. But you know, it's shenamar, fill in the blank. So what happened here? Vav, hey, lamed, and an apostrophe. Well, it really was hello, but the later writers thought it was halacha. So now all of a sudden it's a rule. It's a hard and fast rule that Esau hates Jacob. We've now institutionalized anti-Semitism as a fact of the world that can't be undone. Well, that's true. Yaakov didn't want to live with them, and so he bamboozled them into going the other way. Yeah, yeah.
But it may be inconsequential, because let's look at the history. Whether we say hello or halacha,
right,
it ain't too good for the Jews.
It's not. That's true. So let's now look at the next piece. So the Psikta de Rav Kahana. So the Psikta offers an interpretation on Shir HaShirim. Mi tencha ke'achli. Would that you be like a brother to me? So is being a brother a good thing or a bad thing? Well, if you look in the Bible, being a brother sometimes is pretty terrible. So we say, what do you mean, ach? Eza ach? Which brother would you want to be? Whose brother would you want to be? Kain haragas hevel. Kain killed hevel. Ki Yishmael the Yitzchak. Yishmael hated Yitzchak. Esav and Yaakov, Esav hated Yaakov. The brothers of Yosef and Yosef, the brothers hated Yosef. Rather, what does it mean, ke'achli? Like Yosef was to his brothers, that when he had an opportunity to really stick it to them after Yaakov's death, and they thought he was going to be vicious to them, what does he say? It was from Hashem. I'm not going to harm you. No, I mean no harm. I mean no harm. So the Medrash is acknowledging that within a family, oftentimes it's a disaster, and brothers don't get along, and the Yaakov and Esav relationship was bad, but it wasn't necessarily any worse than the Yitzchak Yishmael or the Kain and Hevel. So, whereas the halacha biyadu Esav son Yaakov means this is somehow really special, that anti-Semitism of Esav towards Israel is in a class by itself. This medrash is saying, not really. Everybody hates everybody. No one's getting along. Families are all disasters. Okay. But let's now go to Bereshis Chav Zayin Memalef from last week's reading. Vayistom Esav et Yaakov al habracha, that Esav was infuriated with Jacob over the stealing of the blessing. Vayomer Esav belibo, Esav says in his heart, Yikrevu yimei evel avi, ve'agat Yaakov achi. The days of mourning for my father shall quickly approach, and I will kill my brother Jacob. So here the Tanchuma says, Esav sona Yaakov. Esau hates Jacob. Not halacha, not that it's a fact of history, an axiom of history. No, it's just this person hated that person. But are we to view the stories of the book of Genesis as Maaseh Avot Siman Labanim? What happened to the ancestors happened to the children? Is it always foreshadowing later events? So we like to read the Bible, not just the stories of the past, but if we want to infuse it with meaning, we'll say it's relevant for us now. Yeah.
In this case, it's different. He's telling you what's in his mind. It means Hashem's telling you what was in his mind. Uh-huh. It's not like he wrote down a will or something.
Right,
like
Billy Bo. But it was enough. It was verbalized enough that the mother, Rivka, found out about it. So it wasn't.
I'm sure he screamed a little bit too. Right?
Yeah.
He personally cried for whatever hours it was.
Yes.
Right,
so
in his head, get buried in the
We're going to get to that. So the idea that Yaakov stole a blessing and that's why Esav hates Yaakov means that Chazal, at least in this instance in Tanchuma, acknowledge that sometimes anti-Semitism has legitimacy, merit. It's not based upon nothing. There is an incident in which our people, our ancestor, did not behave all that well, which precipitated ill feelings that could lead to murder. But we're not entirely blameless. So now let's go to Midrash Tehillim. The Tehillim is commenting on Psalm 25, verse 19. Re'ei o'evai ki rabu v'sinat chamas sinauni. They hated me because of sinat chamas.
Corruption.
Theft. We stole something, and that's why they don't like us. And then Shamra nafshi v'atzilini alavosh ki chasiti bach. But we ask God, preserve us, preserve me, because we're cowering in the shadow of the shelter of your divine wings. So the Medrash Tehillim says like this: Re'ei o'evai ki ra'u ki rabu v'sinat chamas ne'uni im Esav son Yaakov. If Esau hates Jacob, we understand that. He took the firstborn, and that's in a fairly devious fashion. And so Esav was right. Hadin imo. Esav had a legitimate gripe, but now here's the kicker. This is the most important line of the whole night. Aval barbarim vanatiim usherit ha'amim me asiti lahem. The barbarians from the Barbary Coast and the Anatolians and all the other nations, what did we do to them? So we're acknowledging we are not perfect. We have sinned against certain groups, but we didn't sin against everybody, and everybody seems to hate us. That's not fair. So what's the modern day equivalent of it? The modern day equivalent of it is some Shmendrik in Ramallah who has a bad life because of Israeli presence in the West Bank. All right, so he's not going to like us. And he's got a gripe, and he had to wait at a checkpoint in Shuafat for 3 hours to go to the hospital. Okay, so he doesn't like Jews. I get it, he doesn't like Jews. I wouldn't like Jews too if I was in his place. But people who live in Belgium, or people who live in Canada, or people who live in South Korea, or Mongolia, or fellow Jews, why do they have to hate my guts? I didn't do anything to them. So we have enemies. We have people we maybe have wronged, because there's direct conflict. But there are also a lot of other people in the world who we have no interaction with. And yet what? There's anti-Semitism. You know, in Malmo, all the way up in Scandinavia, they say it's the most anti-Semitic city in all of Europe. There's no Jews there. So we didn't do anything to them. So why do they hate us? That's the idea.
You're quoting Belgium and the Scandinavians and
right.
stuff. And even the Torah came after the beginning of the Common Era. So you do have a justification, quote unquote, of the Christians claiming that the Jews killed Christ. So if you're talking about Esau and you're talking about Yaakov,
right.
that could be ancillary to what you just said.
All right. So the bottom line is then that our adversaries will often come up with some justification for their animosity towards us, whether in theological terms, economic terms or political terms, whatever, each place is different. But the rabbis who are the authors of the Agadic texts don't accept those claims as having any basis, you know, any legitimate basis, as opposed to what they're willing to acknowledge about a biblical story where it says beferish that our ancestor acted deviously, you know, b'mirmah v'yikach b'rechatecha, that we can say, but that we were all guilty of killing Jesus, that they didn't want to say. Or that the Jews are guilty of stealing people's businesses. They don't want to say that. There's very little interest in acknowledging contemporary transgressions. Because maybe there aren't any. Maybe the Jews behave very, very well. I don't know.
Isn't it pretty clear that when you're Oral Agoyim, like Abram was a perfect example. He went everywhere, no problem. Nobody hated him.
Well, he had a few run-ins with Paro and Avimelech, but...
both cases had to do with the wife.
All right, he was very well, baby. He was very well-liked. You're right, he was very well-liked. Okay, now let's go to the Igros Moshe. So, but I'm going to get to the meaning of Esav. Who is Esav? And... But I want to discuss more recent rabbis and looking back upon what Chazal say about anti-Semitism. So Igros Moshe says the following, Rav Moshe Feinstein, writing in the 1970s. Tzarich leida, ki ha-sina li-Yisrael mikol ha-amot, the hatred that the Gentiles have for the Jews, higdola migam mi-malchiyot she-anohagim mi-tova. It even holds true in countries that otherwise behave well, meaning there are communist dictatorships and there are fascist dictatorships and there's like the third world where everyone is killing each other. That's terrible. You wouldn't want to live there. But Rav Moshe is saying even in Western countries where the malchut, the government behaves, generally speaking, well and treats its citizens with equal rights, still, even in those places, there's a lot of Jew hatred. The question was about England in particular. Well, this particular question was about some government policy in England in 1977. He quotes the Rashi. It's a halacha that Esav hates Jacob. If it's a halacha, it doesn't change. So here you have an orthodox posik showing his orthodoxy in the sense that what is halacha by its nature? Fixed in place, rigid. It's not. There's no development. There's no evolution. So, if you take the lexicon of Jewish legalisms, halacha as a rigid matter, anti-Semitism is also a rigid matter. It's always going to exist. You can't get rid of it. So sinat esav liyakov lo mishtanet. The af elu shenogot beofen tov sinatang dola beetsam shalachin gchas v'shalom garot behem l'grom be'eva. So therefore, even in Western countries where Jews have political rights and they can vote in elections, it's best not to antagonize the religious and ethnic majority. That's Rav Meisher talking. Then we go to the Tzitz Eliezer. The Tzitz Eliezer also is basically saying that anti-Semitism is everywhere, and you're not going to get rid of it. It's, don't blind yourself to its existence. He quotes the Rashi Halacha Biadua Esav Son Eliyakov, and then he says there's a long history Shashar Daruka Shalmot Shanim, hundreds of years. They're hurting us and harming us and burning our Talmud and destroying our Torah, and so don't turn your eye from it. But Rav Henkin disagreed. As was often the case in halachic matters, the Rav Henkin and Rav Meisher, were at loggerheads over serious and weighty issues affecting American Judaism. So too on matters of anti-Semitism, they disagreed. So I'll read to you what Rav Henkin said, and tell me if you like it or you don't like it. He says, "Va'avon plili, it's a terrible sin or a terrible transgression, mitzad otam ha'matifim ha'patanim, among the rabbis and the darshanim, the speakers in the synagogues, who are always quoting Halacha Esav Son Eliyakov." They love quoting that line, that Rashi. It's their favorite Rashi in the Torah. They bang the table, scream anti-Semitism from the pulpit. I know a lot of pulpit rabbis in the 1950s, 60s, 70s, 80s, 90s. They couldn't speak about anything but anti-Semitism. All right, so they quote that Rashi all the time. And Rav Henkin says it's a mistake. It's a terrible mistake. Zeneged ha'emet. It's against the truth. The Neged Chazal, and even against the writings of Chazal, and against the Bible, the Mikra. She Esav Gufa lo haya rasha tamid. Even Esav himself wasn't always so wicked. V'sinato paska, and his hatred came to an end with the kissing episode. He gave a hug and a kiss, and we don't hear from him again. So yeah, the Medrash says that they knocked his head off with Hushim Ben Dan at the grave. That's a Medrash, it's not in the Pasuk. Okay. The Ayidei Hanhaga Metamet Kamosha. So Esav Rishon. That you can have peace with the Gentiles. And if we don't rock the boat, we try to extend a hand, a friendship, it is certainly possible. Who is honored? He who honors other people. This applies even to our relations with the outside world. We respect them. Ohaviata, and to say to them, "You're my fellow human being. I love you." Hem nasim loavim, and they'll love us in return. Ula hefech, but the opposite is also true. Kishomrim sone ata nasim lasone. If we say we hate you, they're going to say it back. So we hate you too. Masim b'chol yom. So Rav Henkin is arguing that we are able to influence the attitude of Gentiles towards Jews if we adopt a mode of reconciliation. Then good things can happen. And if we adopt the perspective of they're always out to get us, then guess what? They'll be out to get you. That's Rav Henkin's perspective.
Because we don't even let a guy pour a glass of wine.
Right. So there are many aspects of our halachic system, legal minutia, that can be offensive.
It's also we know ourselves. We'll give in to the guy, and then we'll be at the Christmas party. But then I come into God with a
chance. That's true.
Right?
That's yeah. Okay, so now let's now go to the question of what did the rabbis really think of Rome? Because Rome came to be identified with Esau. How that happened, in about 10 minutes we'll get to. But first, what was the rabbinic attitude towards Rome? You might assume it was entirely hostile. After all, what'd they do to us? They burned down the temple, okay? Exiled our people, a lot of bad things. But it was not uniformly bad, at least in the eyes of the rabbis. Let's take a look. Amar Rabbi Shimon Gamliel, Kol yamai eti meshamesh et Abba, lo shimashti oto echad mimeish Esav et Aviv. I served my father, Gamliel. So Shimon Gamliel is the son of Gamliel II, the Gamliel of Yavne. And his son says, "I served him, my years as a young man, but I didn't do even 1/60th of what Esav did for Yitzchak." So here in a medrash, a big rabbi, a nasi, a patriarch of the Jewish people, is saying, "My kibud av v'em was nothing compared to Esav's." why is he saying this? So I don't know, but he doesn't have to say it. Remember, the homiletic realm is really volitional. You say what you want to say, not because you have to say it. In the halachic realm, sort of you're compelled by the force of the law to issue a ruling you think is consistent with God's wishes. But in the homiletic realm, you could say whatever you want. And he says, Esav was 60 times better than me in Kibbutz Av Ve'im.
Could be explaining why Esav is 1.5 billion compared to...
Okay, it could be an attempt to explain why Esav had, you know, it was Legoy Gadol. But who else is known in the Talmud for Kibbutz Av Ve'im? Who is the greatest practitioner of Kibbutz Av Ve'im? In the chat, there are 55 people in the chat. Somebody write in. Who is the greatest practitioner of Kibbutz Av Ve'im? Come on, Dafyomi people. Dama Ben Nesina, okay? He was a goy from the coastal cities, from Ashkelon. And he was the greatest practitioner of Kibbutz Av Ve'im. So at least in certain respects, we're willing to say favorable things about Esav and about heathens. Also, he says, I served my father with begadim luchlachim, filthy garments. Whereas Esav served his father with bigdei malchut. He would go out hunting in the field with his gear, okay, with his AR-15 and his army flak. But then, when he would come to serve the venison to his dad, what would he do? He'd put on a tuxedo, like a maitre d' at a fancy restaurant. Okay, that's what the Reb Shimon Gamliel is saying about Esav. Nice things about him. But really nice things about the Esav of his own time. Not just the Esav of the Bible, but of Edom. Now let's go to the next piece. And I mentioned this once before. This is a Gemara in Shabbos 56b. When was Rome created? Rome was created B'sha'ash and Asah Shlomo at Bad Paro, when Solomon, King Solomon, married the daughter of Pharaoh. Gavriel, the angel, came down and took a stick and put it in the earth, in the ocean, and it became something bigger and bigger and bigger. It became Rome. Alternatively, the day that Yeravam put an Egel HaZahav in Beit El and Dan, what happened? A little hut was set up, and this became Italia of Yavan, the Italian peninsula, Rome. So Rome is very old. Antiquity is respected. I mean, today, antiquity is dismissed as being outdated. But in the olden times, antiquity was revered. So to say that Rome is very old is to speak favorably about it. Then, Bracious Rabba, Amar Bishim Ben Lakish, Hine Tov Ma'od. Where does it say in the Torah of Hine Tov Ma'od?
Creation,
good. Zu Malchut Shamayim. Vehine Tov Ma'od, Zu Malchot HaRomim. So Tov Ma'od is the kingdom of heaven and the kingdom of the Romans. Why would Reish Lakish be saying something favorable about the kingdom of the Romans? Don't we hate their guts?
When did he live?
Mid-third century Eretz Yisrael. The answer is this. There was a healthy dose of respect for Roman administration, that they ran a good government. And they might not be so fond of Jews, and there may be moments where it's bad, but you'd rather live in a so-called first world country by the standards of the third century than live in a backward place. You know, at least they had the infrastructure, they had the institutions of government, they had a court system. It was a real country. And it was better to live there than to live in the forest among the barbarians. Okay?
Isn't the belief of Shem and Yafis something to do with you and your province mixed with the smarts of Yiddishkeit?
Yeah. Yafil Kim Yafis and Yishkam Yol Shem. It's a controversial point, yeah.
And really, in reality, was born to Jewish people by conversion.
Yeah, okay, so we're going to get to that. Yes, very important. Okay, so now one last piece before we get to the issue of who Edom really is. And this is the Gemara in Shabbos. And this is the origin of the story of Rabbi Shimon bar Yochai hiding in the cave. So, Amai Kar L'Rosh Yehudim B'Merchol Makom. Why was Rabbi Yehuda known as the opening speaker, the guy who gets to speak first whenever the rabbis are gathered? The Yatzvi, Rabbi Yehuda, Rabbi Yossi, Rabbi Shimon, there were three rabbis sitting around, Yehuda, Yossi, and Shimon. And Yehuda ben Gerim was with them, whether eavesdropping on them or part of the conversation, but Yehuda ben Gerim. And what is ben Gerim?
Son of the converts.
Son of the converts. So this is not to disparage converts generally, but to say that he wasn't an ethnic kinsman, and so his loyalty to our people was suspect, and he's going to do something of like a Benedict Arnold nature and turn on the rabbis. So, Patach Rav Yehuda V'Amar, Yehuda gets up and says, Kama na'eh ma'asehen shel umazu, how wonderful are the deeds of this Roman Empire. After all, Tiknu Geshvakim, they made marketplaces. Tiknu Gesharim, they made bridges, infrastructure projects. Tiknu Merchatzos, bathhouses. Okay, they did great things. You know, it's a first world country. Rabbi Yossi Shatak. Rabbi Yossi heard this and he kept silent. He didn't want to talk. None of your Shimba Yochai. So Shimba Yochai then gets up and says, Komashe Tiknu, everything that they did, well, Tiknu Lotorach Hasman, they did it for themselves. They didn't do it for our benefit. Yeah, there was some public work spending in our country, but it wasn't so that we should live a happy life. It was so they could benefit. They made marketplaces, Loshiv Ben Zonot, to put prostitutes there. Marachatzot, bathhouses, Ladina Datzman, to pleasure themselves. Gesharim, Litoman Mechas, bridges, so they could put an exorbitant toll, like the Verrazano Bridge. You got to pay $20 to go to Staten Island. Okay? So, Halach Yehuda ben Gerim, V'sipa Divrayim. What happened? Yehuda ben Gerim, who wasn't really loyal to our team, he went and told on the rabbis to the Roman authorities. So what happened? Amru, the Roman authority, said, Yehuda she'ila yitaleh. Yehuda said good things about us. So because he said good things about us, we'll do something good for him. He'll be the primary speaker, the first speaker, whenever the rabbis get together to have conversation. Yossi was quiet. He's neither here nor there. So what happened? He'll be exiled to Tzipori. We'll punish him a little bit. Not too bad, but a little bit of punishment. And Shimon Shegina, and Shimon who said nasty things about us, what's his punishment? Off with his head. So what does he do? He runs away to the cave, to the Ma'aran, and he stays there for 12 years, and he comes out, and he goes back in for a 13th year. You know the rest of the story. Okay, so...
Now this is after the Farba.
Yes.
Like, probably even after 130.
Possibly.
And they're still giving credit to the government and the infrastructure.
Yeah.
After the Korban.
So the destruction of the temple certainly made people rethink their relationship with Rome. And the Bar Kokhba rebellion and its failure and the devastation in the Southland also led people to rethink the vertical alliance with Rome. However, the bottom line is they still controlled the country, and the Jews were not throwing in the towel on Jewish presence in Eretz Israel. So they want to recover economically and also recover spiritually, and we get the Torah learning back on good footing. And that's going to require not being terribly antagonistic to the government. You have to once again have a modus vivendi. So,
from Guy also said the reason Hashem picked them and destroyed the temple.
So there's always a theological perspective that they are the tool, God's tool in chastening Israel for its iniquity. That's the sort of thing that gets said 100 years later. B'shas Maisa, in the moment, it's hard to feel that way. Okay, now let's go to why. Why is Esav, Edom of the Bible, being identified with Rome? Where is Edom geographically in real terms in the Bible? Where?
South of Jerusalem.
Okay, so it's southeast of Eretz Yisrael. It's in basically southwestern Jordan of today. You know, just over the Dead Sea and the Arava line, the border between Israel and Jordan, right there. That's Edom. But Edom expanded over time. And when the temple was destroyed the first time, the Edomites encroached further and further north and west. They got as far north as Hebron and as far west as Ashkelon. So basically the whole southern part of the country was for a time demographically Edomite. When Jews came back after the Babylonian captivity, so Jews didn't conquer territory so much as make their presence felt and disrupt what had been a largely Gentile environment. And the Edomites retrenched back to what had been their historic territory. But they were still around.
But as I understood it, Antipas had forcibly converted.
Okay, good. Good. So what ended up happening? When Rome takes over Eretz Yisrael in 63 before the Common Era. Pompey enters the temple, slashes the curtain, looks inside to see what's in the Kodesh Kadashim. So Jewish sovereignty, the Hasmonean kingdom, has been lost. It only was around for about 80 years, 75 years, maybe 140 to 63 before the Common Era. And now it's gone. Why is it gone? Because Hyrcanus II, Aristobulus II, were fighting each other, a civil war, a fratricidal war, and that allowed the enemy, well, not the enemy, but a big power to waltz on in and take control of the country. What they did was they allowed Hyrcanus to remain as high priest, but as a token figure, really not controlling the government. Who ran the government? So Antipas, and then Antipater, okay? Antipater, the father of Herod, was the right-hand man of Hyrcanus, and really the brains behind the operation, the front man for the Romans. So the relationship between Idumea and Rome is this moment where the beginnings of the Herodian dynasty are an Idumean collaborating with Rome. But were they Jewish? They were Jewish by forcible conversion. That in the days of John Hyrcanus, so we're talking now late 2nd century BCE, the Hasmonean kingdom expanded. It expanded to the north, to the Iturian region, and to the south, in the southeast, in the Idumean region. And the idea was, if you could force people to become religiously Jewish, even if not ethnically Jewish, then you could have something of a homogeneous kingdom. Was it a good idea? Probably not. Was it religiously appropriate? Probably not, but it happened. Now, having happened, so these people, these Idumeans, were not especially devout when it came to Judaism, to the religion. And when it came to, you know, ethnic politics, they were not fond of the true indigenous Jews. So here you have people who are nominally Jewish, but Idumean by background, Edom, collaborating with Rome. So all of a sudden, Esav, which is Edom, is now Rome. But that identification doesn't really happen in the moment. It happens a few centuries later in the literature, meaning the rabbis make that connection after the fact, not while it's really going on. So there are actually two reasons why they make this connection. One is the history of the Idumeans collaborating with the Romans, but the other is having to do with Christian theology and Christian propaganda and apologetics. One of the ideas that the early church fathers put forth was that the church is the real Israel, and biological Israel is no longer a covenantal people. That the new Israel is the spiritual Israel is the church, supersessionism. But it's more than that. It's that the church is Yaakov, and biological Yaakov is now Esav. Whoa, how do you like that? That's a big leap of faith. But for the Goyim, they took the leap, okay? Now, so let's go to the Pasuk. The Pasuk in last week's Torah reading, Parshas Toldos, Vayomer Hashem La, so the oracle says to Rivka, Shnei Goyim Bevitneh, there are two nations in your womb. Ushnei Leumim, and two nations, Me'aski Paredu, from your innards will shoot forth. Ula'om Mila'om Ye'amatz, one will be stronger than the other. V'rav Ya'avod Sa'ir. Rav Ya'avod Sa'ir. So the meaning of Rav Ya'avod Sa'ir is usually that the older will work for the younger. Now, alternatively, the younger will work a lot. Rav, not in the sense of the person, but the amount of avodah. But if you take the perspective of V'rav Ya'avod Sa'ir, then the younger means not Yaakov and Esav, where Esav is the older and Yaakov is the younger, but rather the religious groupings. Judaism of the Jews, of the biological Israel, is the Rav, is the older religion, the parent religion, and Sa'ir is the church, the daughter religion. And how do they interpret it? Rav, Yavod, Sa'ir, the older religion will now be under the boot of the younger religion. That who's in charge now spiritually in the world? The church. That the Jews are Esav and the church is Yaakov. Okay, so what's the Jewish reaction? To flip it back around. No, Yaakov is Yaakov and Esav is Rome. And not pagan Rome of Pompey and Julius Caesar and Hadrian and Titus, and you know, but rather Christian Rome. That Christian Rome is Esav. So this is, you know, anti-Jewish theological gibberish being countered by some Jewish pushback. That Yaakov is Yaakov and Esav is Esav, but Esav happens to be Rome and Christian Rome at that.
But this is the 4th century when Constantine already made Rome. We're not talking about the Julius Caesar
So that's what I said. I said it's not happening in the moment, it's happening significantly later in the 4th or 5th century. But it happens a little bit earlier in the sense that pagan Rome was already being identified with Esav by about the 3rd century, maybe even the 2nd century of the Common Era. Not when Augustus was emperor, not when Julius Caesar was around, but still when it was still pagan.
Now, then why, if they would have followed this Esav thing, they would have believed in one God. Why did they go to the many gods?
It doesn't have to, because it's not really attempting to connect with continuity from the biblical character all the way down. It's just appropriating a name for a purpose. So let's find examples in the writings of the rabbis where Rome is Esav. Rome is Esav. Let's find out. Yerushalmi, we have the following. Amar Rabbi Yehuda, Bei Rabbi Elah, Baruch Rabbi Eidorsh, Kol Kol Yaakov, the hands are the hands of Jacob, the voice is the voice of Jacob, and the hands are the hands of Esav. Kol Oshel Yaakov, Tzoveach, the voice of Jacob is screaming and crying, Mimasha Sulo Yadav Shel Esav Beitar, from what the hands of Esav did to us at Beitar. So when was Beitar? The year 135. The Bar Kokhba rebellion ends disastrously at the last stronghold in Judea at Beitar. I'm sure some of you have been there. It's a tourist attraction, basically. And we're taking a pasuk, the voice of Jacob, the hands of Esav. We're crying out in pain over what happened to us at the hand of Esav at Beitar. Well, who killed us at Beitar? Pagan Rome. Pagan Rome is now Esav. Let's go to the next one. Medrash Tanchuma. Andrianus Melech Edom. Hadrian, the king of Edom. Now, last I checked, Hadrian was the emperor of Rome, not the king of Idumea. But okay, so in Tanchuma, he's known as Melech Edom. Kevan Shekava Sheta Olam Kulo. After he conquered the whole world, Halach Lo Leromi. He went back to Rome. Amar Livnei Paltman Shalo, he said to the people in his palace, Mevakesh ni mikem, I ask of you, Shetasu oti Eloah, make me into a deity. The deification of a Roman emperor was a common thing. It's hard for us to understand that. If a president of the United States asked to be declared a deity, we'd think he was bonkers. But back in Roman times, this wasn't so crazy. They asked to be made to be deified. And what happened? Shri Kavashti et Kol Olam Kulo, and behold, I conquered the whole world. Amrulo, they said to him, Adan lo shata b'iro v'veto. But no, you conquered most of the world, but not his city and his house. Who's the him? The God of Israel. You didn't conquer Jerusalem, and you didn't destroy the temple. Halach v'espiko b'yado. So what did he do? Hechre b'es ha-mikdash, v'yisrael v'chazal ha-romi. So he destroyed the temple and exiled Israel and went back to Rome. Let me ask you a question. Who was the emperor when the temple was destroyed?
It was Vespasian.
Vespasian, right. So why does this say that Hadrian destroyed the temple. Really? This is a very famous piece in the academic writings about the temple destruction, because it seems that the building, the Heichal, was not really knocked down in the year 70. The remnants of the temple, the Jewish temple, still existed 50, 60 years later. And what happened? Hadrian knocked it down. So when he wants to build Aelia Capitolina, he has to really get rid of what was the remnant of what had once been a robust city. And even after 70, Jerusalem was a city. And there were some Jews who floated in and out of there. But he knocked down the last parts of the temple. Now, later on, by the way, in the year 362, when Julian the Apostate thinks about rebuilding the temple, the Jews start the construction project, and they knock down what was there. And the Christians made fun of them. You just knocked down your old temple. This was the Jewish temple, the Beis HaMikdash of yesteryear. It wasn't really, no. That had been knocked down by Hadrian. And what they knocked down was a pagan shrine. And then they wanted to build a temple, but didn't come to pass. Julian was killed in battle, and the whole thing went for naught. But I just bring this up to show you there's a little quirk. If you think Vespasian was the one in Titus who destroyed the temple, yes, they knocked it out of commission, but the building was still partially standing, and Hadrian knocked it down. Okay, now let's go to another piece. Shengim Vitnech, two nations in your womb. Zemit Gai Ba'olamo, Zemit Gai Ba'olamo. Each nation will glorify itself in its own world in its own way. And each one will have its own kingdom and kings. Aristocrats. Who are these aristocrats? Adrianus Be'umot, Hadrian among the nations, Ushlomo Be'Israel, and Solomon in Israel. Okay? Shnei Sinei Goyim Be'Nech, Chlomot Sonim Et Esav. Everybody hates Esav. V'Chlomot Sonim Et Yisrael, and everybody hates the Jews. Sineon Devinaya Be'nech Shnemar Ve'Et Esav Saneti. So basically what this Medrash is saying is that not only are the Jews hated, but Esav is hated. So there's ill will towards, Am Yisrael, that we know, anti-Semitism, but there's also ill will towards Esav. What does that mean? It means that the Roman Empire, for all of its wonderful features, eventually becomes oppressive. And those who are not citizens or ethnic Romans don't want it anymore. And the Pax Romana comes to an end. The world descends into chaos. Okay, the Visigoths sack Rome. So Esav is hated in the sense that Rome is also hated. Large empires, the minority groups in the Soviet Union hated the Soviet Union. The people under Nazi Germany, not just the Jews, but conquered peoples hated Nazi Germany. If you're too big and you take over too many different little groups, they're not going to like you anymore. So Israel is hated and Rome is hated. Now the last piece for tonight, last source, is Gemara Avodah Zarah. And this is one of the Rebbe and Antoninus stories. Rebbe and Antoninus were supposedly best friends, a Roman emperor and a Jewish patriarch. It's all very mythical. This didn't really happen. Rebbe was never close buddies with an emperor of Rome. Maybe just maybe Caracalla in the year 212 visited Palestine. But other than that, Rome had a representative in Caesarea, and maybe Rebbe was on decent terms with that guy. But it's not as though they were buddy-buddy. But they could have corresponded, yes. So anyway, the Talmud has all these stories about how such good friends they were. Amarle, Atina la'amad asi. So Antoninus, the Roman aristocrat, says to Rebbe, am I going to go to heaven? Am I going to go to heaven? Amalei, in, yeah, you're going to go to heaven. Amalei, but he says, Vaksiv, lo yesud lebet Esav. It says in your Bible, there will not be a remnant for the house of Esav. So since I'm Rome, I'm Antoninus, I'm Esav, there won't be a remnant. It can't be that I'll have a portion of the world to come. None of my people are going to have a portion of the world to come. So what does Rebbe respond? Be'ose ma'ase Esav. It's true, that there won't be any remnants, but only among those who do the deeds of Esau. What does that tell you?
If you're a good guy.
If you're a good guy, it's all good, and we're not going to have any racist bone in our religion. It doesn't matter what your ethnic background is. Good people go to heaven. That's now. I wanted to end with that because the temptation is to say that if Esav sona LeYaakov, that there is no exception. There are no righteous Gentiles.
Halacha,
Esav sona LeYaakov. But if we really think that, then we're going to respond in kind and say Yaakov sona LeEsav. And when they ask us, are we going to go to heaven? We'll say you're going to go to 12 feet under and never come back up and give them a good zetz and not say nice things to them. So Rebbe, who, yeah, he probably was on good terms with the Roman administration, and these stories have a kernel of truth to them. He was not anti-Roman. He was not a Romanophile necessarily, but good terms. Exactly. So he could say, you're going to go to heaven. That we don't have to be at loggerheads with my group hates your group and your group hates my group, and we'll damn each other to eternity. We could say a favorable thing, a good word. And Osem Esav, we recognize that Esav represents bad, but his biological descendants or his theoretical descendants don't all have to be like him. It's possible to improve your ways and be a chassid yom ha'olam. Okay. So, I'll take a question. I'll unmute everybody. Actually, can I unmute everybody? I don't even know how to do that. Allow participants to unmute themselves. Yeah. Okay. If you want to ask a question, you can unmute yourself now. We got 2 minutes. Alan Stern, you unmuted yourself. You want to get a question?
No, just...
No. Okay.
I have something.
Okay, ask a question.
In Shir HaMalot, you know, it says, Higdil HaGoyim La'asot, you know, that God has done great things for them.
Yeah.
The nation said. And there's all these things, you know, how, you know, nations are going to bless themselves by Abraham and his descendants. It's like...
It's like
the opposite of what happened.
Well, I wouldn't say that. So the question was, if it says in the Torah that if you bless Israel, you'll be blessed, and if you curse Israel, you'll be cursed, isn't that the opposite of what actually happened? So I meant, you know, the classic rabbinic answer is no. The classic rabbinic answer is that those civilizations that treated Jews favorably themselves found great success, and that those civilizations that did, you know, bad things to the Jews quickly got their comeuppance. And the usual examples given are that after the Spanish Inquisition and expulsion, you know, the Spanish Armada failed in 1588, and Spain ceased to be a major world power, and the British overtook them. Or that, you know, the University of Vienna was like 95% Jewish before the war, and they were the greatest medical school in the world and greatest in all sorts of sciences. And then after the war, they were nothing because the Jews were all dead or gone. I mean, you have many examples of countries that had a golden age that included some religious toleration, including tolerance towards Jews. And then when it comes to an end because of change in policy that people are now, you know, more bigoted, then they are not as successful. Or in fact, maybe take a major tumble.
The non-Jews of the world always use the Yaakov stealing the bracha from Esav and use that as conniving for either business or different ways of manipulating situations. And
yes.
I disagree with the rabbis. They say, well, it's not about business, but or monetary, but it has always been used in that vein.
Okay, so it happens to be that the financial aspect of anti-Semitism is something that the Jewish leadership was always aware of. But in the writings, we tend to focus on, you know, biblical paradigm, God's desire to chasten Israel through the stick of the heathen, and not to think that, well, they're out to get us because we ruined their business. the temptation is always to assume that the other side is hurting us because of their inherent viciousness and rishus, and that we are tzaddikim. In the Jewish literature, and especially in the davening, we ask Hashem to be good to us, never because we deserve it, never because we're tzaddikim, it's rather because of the chesed of the Ribono Shel Olam, the kindness of God, God's mercies. L'mancha Elokim Chayim, Zochein L'chaim. So in davening, we're never tzaddikim, because that's our relationship with Hashem. But in our relationship with the rest of the world, it's sort of taken for granted that we are tzaddikim and they're not. Is that a fair assessment? Probably no. But that's usually how it is described, and not in financial terms.
You got to remember one thing: in the Catholic Church, interest, charging interest among the Catholics is one of the
biggest sins. Yes, yes, yes.
So you had to rely on the Jews.
Yeah.
And we were allowed to do it on our side.
Yes.
So the concept of the hatred toward the Jew is magnified because they are anti-Christian by following a path that is counter our Christian religious path.
Right. So we were guilty of doing something that in their eyes was immoral, but in our eyes was acceptable, and within their system was necessary.
And it fed more hatred because it was anti-Christian.
All right, let's stop here. So next week we shall begin with Christian anti-Judaism, discussing the era of the first half of the first century of the Common Era, including Saul of Tarsus, or Paul as he was known. Okay, bye-bye. See everybody next week.
Bye-bye.